Sustainable Idaho is a collaboration between the Portneuf Resource Council and the ISU Sustainability Club.
Welcome to Sustainable Idaho, the show where we explore the economic, societal, and environmental implications of sustainability within Idaho. I'm Scott Greaves.
And I'm Rachel McGovern.
The following is a copy of Rachel and I's full interview with Ross Furrow. Ross is a fisheries research scientist for the U.S. Forest Service working out of the Rocky Mountain Research Station.
So Idaho salmon need three things. They need natal habitat, which is freshwater spawning and rearing habitat. They need a suitable migration corridor to and from the ocean. And then they need an estuary and an ocean. And Idaho fish currently have access to two of those necessary components. They have high quality natal habitat. They have an estuary and an ocean. What they really lack is a suitable migration corridor. And that migration corridor has been dramatically altered by human development. There are currently 8 dams and 325 miles of reservoir in what was formerly a free-flowing river. That creates issues with delays in migration, higher predation rates, lack of food, elevated water temps. And to illustrate the water temps, in 2015, 96% of sockeye destined for Idaho died between Bonneville Dam and Lower Granite Dam, the 8th dam, as a result of elevated temperatures. There's a group called the Independent Science Advisory Board, and in their 2018 report, they termed the hydro system as a controllable factor, which means we have discretion to improve conditions. We know that the ocean is also changing, primarily as a result of climate change, and the ISAB termed climate change an uncontrollable factor in terms of the ocean. So except for efforts to limit carbon emissions and reduce climate change, we don't have a lot we can do to improve ocean conditions. Mm-hmm. In order to understand recovery, it's really important to understand historical abundances. And there's a term called the shifting baseline syndrome. It was postulated by Pauly in 1995. And essentially what the baseline syndrome means is we tend to judge resources based on our contemporary experiences. And the danger of that is that we completely underestimate actual production potential, and we may also set unrealistically low recovery goals. And some folks have also termed this a lack of faith in nature. To give you some background on the abundances we formerly had in the Columbia Basin, the Columbia River Basin was the most productive Chinook habitat in the world. In 1805, Lewis and Clark came through and they wrote, salmon numbers are, quote, almost inconceivable. And if you think about that for a minute, Lewis and Clark came across the Great Plains where they saw literally millions of bison, antelope, and deer. Yet they struggled for words to describe salmon abundances. How many salmon? Estimates vary from 10 to 16 million adults enter the Columbia every year, and 2 to 6 million of those came into the Snake River. And it's important for Idaho folks to understand the Snake River Basin was disproportionately important. Although it comprises only less than 20% of the flow in the Columbia, it produced more than 50% of the steelhead, nearly 15% of the summer Chinook, and about 40% of the spring Chinook. And these enormous salmon runs brought immense ecological, cultural, recreational, and economic values to Idaho every year. Salmon are essentially an Idaho and Northwest icon. I live in Salmon, Idaho, which is along the Salmon River, which is near the Salmon River Mountains. So we name our places after these fish. Mm-hmm. And to illustrate their immense values, in 1959, you could harvest 2 wild salmon a day and fish the entire Snake, Salmon, Clearwater, and their Columbias, and their tributary, for a total of up to 3 months. And these fish have obviously been part of the fabric of the Shoshone, Bannock, and Nez Perce tribal culture for about 12,000 years. They were also an essential component in communities like Salmon, Chalice, Stanley, and others up and down the Salmon, Clearwater, and Snake. And in recent years, only a fraction of those areas that formerly were open to fishing still support a fishery. And those are for hatchery fish. And a lot of these salmon-based economies in Idaho are drying up as a result of the endangered status of our fish. To illustrate what we've lost, in the Snake River, abundances declined from returns of 2 million adults in the late 1800s to to less than 1,200. That's 1,200 in 1995, which is why these fish were listed. The cause of those declines, as reported by the federal agencies, are what are termed the four H's. The first H being habitat degradation, second one, excessive harvest, third, hatchery programs that have negatively impacted wild fish, and finally, the hydro system, both impassable dams like Hell's Canyon and so-called passable dams like Lower Granite. And if we look specifically at central Idaho and the wild fish I work with, a recent analysis suggests that the Middle Fork formerly supported nearly 50,000 adult Chinook in the 50s and 60s. In 2019, the Middle Fork supported less than 1% of that. In 2020, less than 2% of that. So you can ask, what happened? What caused these severe 99% declines? Well, certainly all four H's contributed, but the evidence in the Middle Fork suggests that one H in particular is the cause of the declines. And multiple entities over the past 20 years have concluded that the proximate causes of declines in the Snake River Basin is the hydro system. And illustrate why, there's a survival metric that we biologists use that's called the smolt to adult return rate. The acronym is SAR. In the 1960s, with four dams in place, SARs ranged from 3.5 to 6.5%. So for every 100 smolts that went out, 3 to 6 adults came back. After the four additional dams were added in the 60s and 70s, SARs have averaged 0.7%, less than 1% for the past 18 years. And when SARs are less than 2%, the population can't maintain itself, which is why our fish are at imminent risk of extinction. We can also use the Middle Fork as a control to assess the importance of different H's and other factors. Middle Fork, because of the bulk of it lies within wilderness, has exceptional natal habitat. There are no hatchery fish stocked in the Middle Fork. It contains no hatcheries. And harvest rates are low based on ocean tag returns and management of the treaty and non-treaty fisheries downriver. So as a result, three of the four H's really don't apply to the Middle Fork. We can take them off the table. The fourth H, hydro system, does. And for decades, much of the focus on salmon recovery has been to restore natal habitat, that's spawning and rearing habitat. And there are excellent collaborative habitat restoration projects in the Lemhi, Pessimera, Yankee Fork that benefit fish and wildlife and restore stream functioning. However, I want to be very clear. If natal habitat degradation was the cause of salmon declines, then salmon in areas like the Middle Fork that have high-quality habitat should be faring much better than stocks in graded habitat. And our data illustrate salmon declines in the Middle Fork are parallel to other populations, despite that exceptional habitat. So as important as restoration of degraded habitat is, natal habitat restoration alone, without actions to restore the migration corridor, will not restore Idaho salmon. So the Middle Fork essentially illuminates the fact that in order to restore these populations, effective actions must be taken outside of Idaho in the migration corridor, where humans have dramatically altered conditions. And the situation is urgent because these stocks are literally bouncing around just above the extinction line. But if we lose these fish, there are no others on the planet that will replace them.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was fantastic. Thank you very much for that. I have a question from what you said there. So how do we know what the historical populations of salmon were? Is it done through isotope analysis? Is it some sort of historical record that we draw from? How do we know what the fish stocks used to be?
Yeah, so the recent analysis that we did for the Middle Fork estimating the 1950s and 60s abundances, fortunately in Idaho, the state of Idaho has been monitoring salmon populations since the 1940s. And they do it by counting the reds or nests that female salmon build. And most of our female salmon dig one red, and our sex ratio in our populations are typically about 1 to 1. So if we count reds, we can multiply that times 2 and give us an approximation of adult numbers. And so we use the data going back into the 1950s and 60s to to look at where they used to do red counts, and then we expanded those counts to say, okay, if they had counted all the streams in the Middle Fork, what would the total have been? And if they had counted the reds at the end of the spawning period, because historically they typically counted reds at what they call the peak time. They were looking for a trend, not a total estimate. So for more recent estimates of historical abundance, we can use actual empirical data. Mm-hmm. The estimates for like the Columbia in the 1800s, those are in part based on commercial harvest records, and they're also based on estimates that people have done for the indigenous people's harvests. And, you know, there's a number of different techniques that people have used to try to get back to estimating, okay, what was the population of tribes along the lower Columbia? How many people were there? What portion of their diet was composed of salmon, et cetera, et cetera? What kind of harvest rates could they have had with the techniques they had? So there's that approach, as well as actual empirical data there too from commercial harvest records. There's some excellent work that was done by a biologist named Jim Lukatowicz. He's in the state of Oregon, where he developed estimates of historical abundances based on that commercial fishery. And he's also got a great book called Salmon Without Rivers that I would recommend to everybody that wants to understand salmon recovery in the Columbia Basin.
Oh, okay. So something else you said at the beginning there was we have to be careful not to compare salmon populations to recent population counts, i.e. ones that are very, very small, and we have to make sure we actually recognize that the population used to be much larger. So is that a concern that you have when we're looking to manage, you know, when this becomes a political issue and, you know, they're saying, well, we had more than last year. Is that sort of an issue that we're only comparing ourselves against a very poor baseline? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, you are understanding. So the shifting baseline syndrome, again, as postulated by Pauly, and I'd encourage you to look up that paper, 1995. So yeah, so the shifting baseline syndrome, it's very serious because we underestimate actual potential. And the other thing that happens, as you just alluded to, is when there's an increase, people tend to way overestimate what that means. So again, in 2019, the red surveys in the Middle Fork tell us that we were less than 1% of what we estimated was there in the 1950s and 60s. In 2020, we had about twice as many fish, which was still less than 2% of what was there in the 1950s and 60s. But yet, I've actually seen newspaper articles where people have said, we had a big increase in fish in the Middle Fork. Well, we didn't have a big increase. Both years are abysmally low. So understanding what historical potential was and historical numbers were helps us put current numbers in context. And we don't want to be saying, you know, these are record runs when they're a fraction of what was there. There's a number of pieces of evidence of that. And in that paper I mentioned on the shifting baseline syndrome, there's records of, for example, returns into the Columbia over recent decades where they're saying a record return. Well, it's nowhere near a record when we had 6 to 12 million fish coming into the Columbia Basin. So it's really important to understand the historical context. Another example of shifting baseline syndrome that isn't with anadromous fish. So I worked in the Bigwood River drainage in the past near Haley and Ketchum. That was a phenomenal fishery historically. And they actually caught resident rainbow trout there over 10 pounds. Mm. Just phenomenal growth rates and really large fish. Well, in recent years, you know, that fishery has been degraded in large part because of development along the river. And currently, you know, a trophy fish is about 3 pounds. So again, a 3 pound rainbow is a great fish, but it pales in compared to what was there historically. So understanding that historical potential gives us the ability to not judge current populations incorrectly. And it also gives us the ability to say, okay, if we want to restore this, this is what the goal should be. We should be trying to restore it back much closer to what was there historically, because that potential in a place like the Middle Fork, where the habitat is still intact, is still there.
I guess that sort of builds into this question that Rachel and I have written down. And We're really interested in where do you see the future of salmon restoration going? So what are the actions that we can take going forward that are actually going to have meaningful impact in this context of a much larger historical population and us sort of at the moment seemingly sort of fighting over small numbers of change?
So I think it goes back to what I started out with. Understand, first of all, the components that salmon need. They need that natal habitat, they need a suitable migration corridor, and they need a suitable estuary and ocean. And again, a lot of emphasis has been placed on natal habitat, and that's certainly really important. So, one of the steps is making sure that we do have intact, high-quality, diverse natal habitat. We have that in central Idaho. We have that in abundance, fortunately. So for our fish, then it's a matter of doing a triage and saying, okay, where's the main problem? Well, as I talked about, the main changes that humans have made in this system affecting Idaho fish is in that migration corridor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really the place that, again, there's 20 years of data that points to the hydro system as the place to make improvements. And as I said, the Independent Science Advisory Board said, you know, we have discretion to make changes there. So that really, for our fish, is where the emphasis needs to be.
So you have
simultaneously,
you have the ability, or the discretionary power to make changes there. So does that mean you have some sort of legal power to make changes to the dams that exist in the system?
Well, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but you know, there is something called the Endangered Species Act, and the Endangered Species Act requires federal agencies to do what it takes to recover populations. So, you know, there is some legal standing there, and again, there is discretion to change how that hydro system is managed to improve things for the fish. The other thing I was starting to say is, you know, the other obviously big issue is climate change. Unfortunately, climate change is exacerbating the issues in the migration corridor. Those warm temperatures are going to continue to get worse. So whatever we can do to restore things to more of a natural river, that's going to dramatically benefit salmon and steelhead recovery. At the same time, you know, we as humans, both nationally and internationally, we have to get our act together on climate change. We have to inform folks that, you know, this is real, it's happening, and we have to start taking steps to try to mitigate that, reduce carbon emissions in particular, and not continue the status quo. And because there are certainly changes that are very frightening going on in the ocean, changes in productivity cycles. And just to illustrate a little bit about the ocean, so the ocean has a big effect on our salmon returns. We understand that. When there's a favorable ocean, which means, you know, suitable temperatures, more food, more upwelling of high quality food, there's more salmon. When we have an unfavorable ocean, there's fewer salmon. Now, those cycles have been going on for eons. The problem that's been occurring in recent years, and again, this is out of my area of expertise, but it appears that what used to be like decadal cycles in the ocean are now changing much more dramatically. We may be in one cycle for a couple of years and then it flips. And that's probably going to continue to get worse with climate change. So we definitely have to get our act together on climate change. But let me put the hydro system in the context with climate change and with the ocean. So there's a study called the Comparative Survival Study, acronym is CSS. And in their 2019 report, they report some really powerful data. And they compare the SARs, the small to adult returns, between the Snake River with 8 dams, the Yakima River with 4 dams, and the John Day with 3 dams. And the John Day with 3 dams, SARs from 2000 to 2017, 18-year period, averaged 3.6. The Yakima with 4 dams, SARs averaged 2.5. The Snake with 8 dams, as I said earlier, during that same period, has averaged 0.7. And the important point of this is that the difference in SARs, these fish all experience the same ocean conditions, the same sea lion predation, the same treaty and non-treaty fishery. The difference between the three is the number of dams they pass. So that's a real powerful data set to say, yeah, the ocean is important. However, this data clearly shows the hydro system is having huge effect.
It almost seems, everyone we spoke to, it just seems so frustrating because it seems very clear what the main issue is, but very difficult to address. Being able to say, you know, this is what we're going to do for dams in the future, or this is what we expect to happen to dams in the future. No one's been able to make that statement because it seems the issue of the dams involves so many stakeholders, so many actors, that making meaningful change there to the dams that would benefit the salmon is just a very complicated issue.
Well, I guess my response would be, I think the science is extremely clear and it points to where the problem is, what's changed the most, where we need to focus if we're going to recover these fish. The thing that has hampered recovery is not listening to the science, which is not unique to this issue, certainly.
Yep.
And there's also been a tremendous amount of political interference. And sadly, there's also been a lot of distortions of the truth. So a lot of members of the public are really confused about this issue like they are in other issues because they're getting competing information. In many cases, one side of the information has been a distortion of the truth. So again, radio shows like yours, really important because the more people are exposed to information and accurate information and people speaking the truth, the more likely they're going to understand what the issues are and, you know, urge their elected representatives to take the right actions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So do you think that's the main issue when it comes to the communication of the science then, is that there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between the scientists who are producing this science and then the public sort of receiving and hearing this information and translating that into pressure on their political appointees?
Yeah, in my experience, I think that's very accurate. You know, if the science was listened to, basically, there's decades of science that illuminate the path to recovery. The question that remains is if the public and the decision makers understand the issue and care enough about salmon to take those actions. And the concerning thing about that is we don't have a lot of time. We need to take these actions really, really soon because our fish are at high risk of extinction. So in closing, one of the things I want to emphasize for people is how unique and valuable and irreplaceable these Central Idaho wild fish are. There are no other spring-summer Chinook in the world that migrate so far and climb so high. These are literally world record holders, and they're irreplaceable. Secondly, they have extremely diverse life histories with multiple freshwater ages and saltwater ages. Third, despite extremely low abundances, they still are genetically diverse, which is really important for future persistence. Fourth, they have demonstrated resiliency, and resiliency is basically ability to withstand negative conditions that would drive them to extinction, and then correspondingly ability to respond when conditions improve. And from 2001 to 2003, we had higher spring flows, so more of the smolt survived through the migration corridor. When we have more water, there's faster travel time, more survive. And then we had a simultaneous increase in ocean productivity. And that resulted in 5 times as many adult salmon returning to the Middle Fork. So that's demonstrated resiliency. When conditions improve, those fish will respond. And fifth, these fish are uniquely positioned in high elevation, what we call cold water refugia, so they're positioned to adapt to an uncertain future of climate change. So the bottom line is, for Idaho, and specifically Central Idaho wild populations, all the building blocks to recover them still exist. We have these unique, wild, genetically diverse fish. We have diverse life histories and local adaptations. We have demonstrated resiliency, and then we have this exceptional, high-quality, diverse natal habitat to support their recovery. So there's no question if effective actions are taken to restore more favorable migration corridor conditions, these fish are going to respond, and their high resiliency suggests they'll do so rapidly. One example of that resiliency, the average female has 5,000 eggs. So for every additional 100 or 200 or 500 adults that successfully return, that's an enormous increase in potential production. So that's why we would see a fairly rapid response when conditions are improved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point to make. It's not over sort of thing. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's kind of a friend of mine calls it dynamic tension. On the one hand, they're really in trouble and we have to act soon. But on the other hand, there's also good news. There's a lot of cause for optimism if, again, as I said earlier, the public and decision makers care enough to recover these fish.
Mm. Just really quickly before you go as well, what is your view on hatcheries? Are they important in terms of making sure the population doesn't go extinct and you know, we're introducing fish into the river that people can use for fishing, and or actually are they having a negative effect?
I guess my response to hatcheries would be they've been useful to maintain some fishing opportunity, because without the hatchery programs, you know, we would have generations of anglers now that don't know what it's like to fish for a steelhead or a Chinook salmon. And so the idea of maintaining opportunity and keeping those people involved and having them become advocates for recovering fish is really, really important. There are different kinds of hatcheries. There are also what are termed conservation hatcheries. So like for the redfish lake sockeye, that's a conservation hatchery program to try to maintain the genetics of that population. So it's very different than the hatchery programs to maintain some harvestable hatchery fish for Chinook and steelhead. The programs to maintain fisheries have risks. There's a risk that those hatchery fish will stray into wild production areas. And we know from a number of studies that when that happens, there's a loss in production of wild fish. There was a recent paper, I think it's Christie, it's either 2016 or 2018, and he found that after one generation in a hatchery, more than 700 genes were altered in steelhead. So when fish are brought in the hatchery, you know, they become less robust than the wild populations. And the other thing to keep in mind about the future is, regardless of how quickly we get our act together on climate change, there are going to be effects. I mean, we're obviously already facing them, and there's going to be a lag time before we start turning around some of these temperature effects and other things. And we need salmon that are going to be able to adapt to different conditions. And fish like we have in the Middle Fork right now, they have high resiliency, they have high adaptability. It's a very dynamic system. There's fires, there's floods, there's debris flows. And so they have the genetics to adapt. Hatchery fish don't go through that same natural selection process. So they are not going to be positioned to adapt in the future. So that's why it's so critical that we keep these wild fish. And, you know, there's a lot of people that would probably say that once we recover these wild populations, the goal should be to continue to do that. And in areas where we have strictly hatchery fish now, to rebuild natural populations, because again, they are going to be most suited, most adapted to persist in an uncertain future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to Scott and I's full interview with Russ Thoreau. Join us next Tuesday morning at 7:35 for Sustainable Idaho.
Sustainable Idaho airs Tuesday morning at 7:35. Thank you to our partners, the Portneuf Resource Council and ISU Sustainability Club. Links to this and past programs can be found at kisu.org.